Researchers have had a field day, in a sense, with the Medicaid system in Oregon. A few years back, the state set up a system to offer Medicaid, the Oregon Health Plan, to more people. Some got in and got insured, and some did not. The presence of all those people newly insured and a big number still uninsured provided a whole lot of people to track to look for a variety of findings. The Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, it is called, and there are more recently published findings to go through. Catherine Baker's our guest on The Exchange. She's a professor of health economics and acting chair in the Department of Health Policy and Management at Harvard University. Her research focuses primarily on the factors that drive the distribution, generosity, and effectiveness of public and private health insurance, with a particular focus on health insurance finance and the effect of reforms on the distribution and quality of care. Catherine Baker, thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
I have to believe you often have a lot of irons in the fire, because this is a very hot field to be studying. And, of course, you're studying not just health delivery and effectiveness, but also the economic end of things.
Yes, this seems like a key time in public policy to improve delivery of health care to lots of people who are newly insured, but also to keep in mind the cost of providing that care and how we can provide it the most effectively that we can.
So refresh our memories on what led to the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, the set of circumstances that brought this all together.
This was a really unusual chance to pin down the effects of health insurance, because Oregon had a waiting list for its Medicaid program for low-income adults. States have choices about whether to cover poor adults who aren't disabled or over age 65 or in specific demographic categories. And Oregon had a program for that group, but had a waiting list for it and drew names from the waiting list by lottery. Now, they saw the most fair way to allocate those scarce spots in the program, but it provided a really rare opportunity for researchers to study the effects of insurance. And I would love to tell you why the lottery was so important, if we have a minute for introduction of that.
Absolutely.
If you just look at the health outcomes or the health care use of people who are on Medicaid compared to people who are not on Medicaid, there are lots of other factors going on that might give you a mistaken impression of the program. For example, people on Medicaid have a higher mortality rate than people who are not on Medicaid. That doesn't mean that Medicaid is killing them. There are lots of ways you get on Medicaid, such as being very low income or having a disabling health condition, that are bad for your health in and of themselves. So if you don't take those into account, you might get a mistaken impression about the effects of the program itself. The lottery takes care of all of those confounding factors for us, because we can compare the people who got drawn in the lottery by the luck of the draw to people who remained uninsured because they didn't get that lucky lottery number. And by comparing those two groups, we can really isolate the effects of the Medicaid program on health care use, health outcomes, and financial security. So this was a really rare opportunity for researchers that we were really glad to have the opportunity to take advantage of.
So it is the randomness of the sampling, then, that makes this such a good opportunity.
Right. It's just like a randomized controlled trial for a drug. You would never accept results from a study that didn't have a control group or a placebo group. You need to know what would have happened in the absence of the drug. And this is just like a randomized controlled trial of Medicaid, which almost never happens.
Right. So, and there were very big numbers, right? I mean, they were talking about like more than 12,000 people altogether between the two groups.
Yeah. On the lottery list, there were almost 90,000 people. 30,000 people got selected in the lottery and the rest didn't. So this is a really large scale experiment.
Oh, very, very large scale then. And in this way, you begin to iron out some of the differences that can come from small groups. And had that been the general state of things up until the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, that you've been trying to do studies with very, very small groups of people?
Well, there's almost never a chance to have a random assignment to Medicaid versus a control group, even in a small group. So what many researchers had done is try to take advantage of idiosyncrasies in program eligibility. Maybe people who are, kids who are under age 6 are eligible, but kids who are 7 and older aren't. Or maybe one state expands its program and a neighboring state doesn't. So you can do comparisons that way that are better than not taking factors like poverty and underlying health need into account, but aren't really as good as a randomized controlled trial in pinning down the effect of the program.
Now, based on the various places in which findings from the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment have been published, I mean, as varied as the New England Journal of Medicine a year ago and economic journals this year, American Economic Review's May issue has another bit of findings where you're the lead author. So it seems like this is the kind of thing researchers would have been fighting to get a piece of.
Yes, and we knew it was a really rare opportunity, so we gathered as much data as possible, which is why we've had the opportunity to explore the effects on healthcare use and on credit reports and on labor market participation and on health. We gathered data using mail surveys and in-person surveys. We got blood samples to measure people's cholesterol and diabetic blood sugar control. We got Social Security records. We got hospital records and emergency department records and credit reports so that we could really map out all the different ways Medicaid affects people's lives. And that resulted in publications in the Journal of Science, the New England Journal of Medicine, the Quarterly Journal of Economics. We really tried to cover the waterfront.
A whole bunch of things to talk about on that waterfront when we come back and talk more with Catherine Baker. She's a researcher at Harvard University and a professor of health economics there as well. We'll come back and talk more with her about the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment. You can join us when we come back and talk more about this at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, in which thousands of people put their names in to get additional slots provided by the Oregon Health Plan, the Oregon version of Medicaid, several years ago. And of those thousands of people, several thousand were drawn by lottery to be included in the Oregon Health Plan, and of course the rest were not. So this gave researchers this vast field of people to draw from in generally similar circumstances, but some had health insurance and some didn't. And so they've been looking at these at a lot of things in these people for several years now. Catherine Baker is our guest on the exchange, professor of health economics at Harvard University, and you can join our discussion here at 800-838-3760, 541-552-6782, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Dr. Baker, I want to come back, because you were just talking about you had cholesterol levels, you had Social Security numbers. I'm going to guess, but I want to make sure that we get this out there so that people can breathe a little easier in our audience. The information was tightly controlled, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. Of course, we were very concerned with maintaining privacy and human subjects protections. We did not use people's Social Security numbers, and the data that we had as researchers was all de-identified. So I have a unique study ID number for each of the study participants, but any identifying information like names or addresses has been stripped out of the data before we analyzed it. So we take those protections very seriously and we're careful to maintain that.
And just in terms of handling the data, I can imagine a lot of bleary eyes at the computer with the reading glasses coming on after a few hours. There's a lot of stuff in here that you could go through.
Yes, we were able to build a great team to work on this project, and it involved researchers on the East Coast, researchers in Oregon, people with different training like epidemiology, economics, medicine, so that we could really come at this from a lot of different perspectives. It's an unusually rich data source, and we've also taken care to make sure that the data is publicly accessible in a, of course, a protected
non-identified
way, but we've made all of the data that we've analyzed thus far available for other researchers because we think it's a great opportunity to study lots of different outcomes of health insurance.
Oh, so you're not talking about publications, you're talking about the actual raw data available
to
researchers.
So we've of course published any findings that we've generated to date, but we've also made the data set available so that other researchers can study it.
There are so many ways you could have gone with the research. I mean, what was the biggest finding you in particular wanted to get some answers about?
Well, I think it's important to study both the costs of the insurance expansion and the benefits of the expansion. As you mentioned, I'm an economist, so I always want to look at costs and benefits. And on the cost side, we wanted to gauge the way that health insurance changed people's health care use. And I think that that's not the way most people think about health care use. They don't think of that as a cost of insurance. They think of that as the point of insurance. Isn't the whole point to get you access to health care? But I would argue that nobody actually wants an MRI or surgery. They want to be healthier. They want their heart attack treated. They want their headache to go away. The outcomes that people care about are those improvements in health and longevity. And the way you get those outcomes is by using more healthcare resources, potentially. So we wanted to look at how it changed the patterns of care that people got: preventive care, doctor's office visits, hospitalizations, emergency department visits. And then we wanted to look at two different kinds of benefits in particular. One is the health consequences, which I think come to mind first. What happens to people's physical health? What happens to their mental health, which is really important and I think sometimes underappreciated, what a serious health burden to the population this is. We also wanted to look at the benefits in terms of financial protection. And I think that gets lost in a lot of the discussion about health insurance. It's not just supposed to get you access to health care when you're sick, which is clearly very important, but it's also supposed to prevent you from getting evicted from your apartment because you couldn't pay your rent because you had an expensive hospital bill. So it should offer people financial security and peace of mind as well as access to care. So we wanted to be sure to measure all of those different things.
Did you start with a particular hypothesis or theory, something as simple as insurance equals better health outcomes?
This is a really interesting area to study because I think it is not so clear how insurance is likely to affect those things, both in general and in specific how Medicaid is going to affect things relative to being uninsured. Ahead of time, there were people arguing both sides of that. Some people said Medicaid is a terrible program. It's not going to improve people's access to health care or their health outcomes because it doesn't pay providers enough, so people won't get all that much additional access to care. The uninsured are already consuming a lot of care in the form of uncompensated care, charity care, bad debt, emergency department visits. So really, Medicaid's not going to make any difference. And then there were other people who were arguing Medicaid is going to improve health by so much. It's going to manage chronic conditions. It's going to get people out of the emergency department and into the doctor's office, getting preventive care. It's really going to improve those conditions, and it's going to save money because it'll get people out of the emergency department. So there were people on both sides of that hypothesis, and that made it particularly important to get really solid evidence.
And do we have any conclusions we can definitively say, at least within the confines of this study?
We have a lot of different findings from the data that paint a pretty nuanced picture of the program, which to me rings true, but puts to rest some extreme views of the program on both sides. It puts to rest the unduly pessimistic view that Medicaid is a terrible program and is actually killing people relative to being uninsured. And you did read in some sources that Medicaid was worse than being uninsured. And our study findings show that that is clearly not true. People are much better off on Medicaid than they were when they were uninsured. And I would love to get into more of the details of that.
Oh, yeah.
But on the flip side, we can also put to rest the unduly optimistic view of the program, which is that it improves people's health and efficiency of healthcare utilization by so much that it actually saves money. And in fact, there's no evidence consistent with that. Expanding health insurance in the form of Medicaid costs money. People use more healthcare. So that leaves us in the neither black nor white world, but in the gray reality of their real benefits to the program for enrollees and their real costs in terms of public expenditures on the program. And policymakers need to weigh those costs against the benefits in deciding what to do with the program.
Ah, and there we come to one of the major points is when we talk about policymakers, we're talking about achieving policy goals often through the political process, which is very much a black and white binary A or B, good or bad kind of proposition these days, isn't it?
Yet we can get so much more detail in this one-hour program than you can fit on a bumper sticker. Really?
Yes, true. It's one of the things we like about the exchange.
Yeah, so that the public discourse is not really geared towards a nuanced discussion about relative costs and benefits and how the program might be improved and who's better off and how care is changing. It really boils down in a lot of people's minds to, does Medicaid save money? Does Medicaid save lives? And those are important questions, but they're such a small slice of the picture.
We are talking to Catherine Baker from Harvard University. She's a professor of health economics there, about the Oregon health insurance experiment, which took all these thousands of people who had applied for additional slots in Oregon's Medicaid program, the Oregon Health Plan. Some got in, some didn't. It was done by lottery, therefore by randomization. We had a whole bunch of people to look at who were insured, newly insured, and a lot of people who still were not insured. It's been quite of a gold mine for the use of researchers like Dr. Baker. You can join us on the exchange as we talk about the findings, and there are a lot lot of findings to talk about. 800-838-3760 around the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. First call from Chris in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Catherine Baker.
Hi. Please explain how when a person who's been on the Oregon Health Plan dies, the state then takes money from their whatever assets they have remaining when they die.
Okay. I'm not even sure Catherine Baker would know about that. Chris, thanks for the question. Catherine, is that a mechanism you're familiar with?
I'm sorry. Unfortunately, it's not.
All right. So but the information that you generally dealt with was whether these people were insured or not, the procedures they got, a lot of stuff like that.
Yes, and we were able to interview thousands of these people who got insurance through the lottery and people who did not to collect information about their overall financial well-being and clinical measures of their health, including a depression screen, blood samples to measure cholesterol and diabetic blood sugar control, height and weight to get obesity, blood pressure, so we could really collect a lot of information about them.
All right. When you come back and say that this is a fairly nuanced set of findings you end up with and people want the easy ones, did it save lives, did it save money, we could get to a situation where, yes, we saved a few lives, yes, we saved a few dollars. It's not a total wash. We have a somewhat healthier population and a somewhat more financially well-off population. Could it be that simple, that nuanced?
Well, I think that the individuals on the program, on the insurance program, are much better off financially, but it costs money overall. It doesn't save money. People on Medicaid used about 25% more healthcare services than the uninsured. They increased their doctor's office visits and their preventive care, which I think had been the hope of a lot of policymakers, but they also used more emergency department visits, had more hospitalizations, so there was no reduction in healthcare spending when people got insurance. They didn't get out of the emergency department and into the doctor's office. They went to the doctor and they went to the hospital and they used more prescription drugs and they went to the emergency department more.
Is it possible changes like that take place over a much longer time than you had in this study? I mean, basically you had the lotteries in 2008, is that right?
Yes, the lottery was in 2008 and we have been collecting data since, and that's a great point that the study results to date focus on the first 2 years of insurance coverage through about 2010. Longer run effects might be very different, especially, you know, healthcare utilization patterns might change over a longer window. We didn't see them dropping off within the first 2 years, but something different could happen over a longer time. We didn't see any physical health improvements that we could discern in this two-year window, and I think that was surprising to a lot of people. People expected improvements in blood pressure or cholesterol. We didn't detect any statistically significant improvements in those within the first 2 years. So some people said, well, maybe it takes longer. Maybe after 5 years you would see reductions in blood pressure. I'm not sure I would necessarily expect that. The reason we looked at those conditions like high blood pressure or high cholesterol was that they're reasonably prevalent in the population. Enough people have them that you have a chance of improving things. And there are medications and other treatments available that have where evidence suggests they should work within the first 6 months if they're going to work. So the fact that something didn't happen within the first 2 years, to me, suggests that something needs to be different about the way people are being treated to get that improvement in high blood pressure. Think about all the steps that have to happen between getting insurance and having improved blood pressure. You have to go to the doctor. The doctor has to notice that you have high blood pressure, has to prescribe some treatment, perhaps a prescription. You have to take that medication as directed. You have to renew it regularly. It has to work, and then we have to be able to measure the high blood pressure. Something in that chain didn't change substantially over the first 2 years, and that suggests that there's room for improvement.
Which is why I asked the question, because you're talking about changing behaviors that often don't change quickly. I mean, if you're talking about a person who is showing up at a doctor's office with high blood pressure, they're probably well into their adult years. I'm going to guess mid-30s or beyond, but this is just a wild guess. And so they've already developed habits about how they consume medicine. It often involves, for somebody who doesn't have any money, going to the emergency room when there's a crisis. And it seems to me that something you've been doing through your entire adult life is going to be a difficult habit to turn around in a short amount of time. And so, I mean, part of the procedure is not just the blood pressure medication itself, but just going to the doctor's office.
Right. And I think that that's the kind of behavior change that people have trouble with regardless of their insurance status, whether it's Medicaid or private insurance or Medicare or being uninsured. We know that modifying something like high blood pressure or obesity is something that a lot of people struggle with. Now, in terms of emergency department use, the interesting thing is that we didn't just see people continuing to go to the emergency department. We saw an increase in visits to the emergency department of around 40%. So people went substantially more once they got insurance. And that's consistent with the fact that going to the emergency department is really expensive if you're uninsured. There's a misconception that because emergency departments can't turn people away who are in need of critical care, that means that people are going and getting care for free. People get an enormous bill when they go to the emergency department. They may or may not be able to pay it, but facing that huge cost is a deterrent to the uninsured. People are less likely to go to the emergency department if they're not truly desperate for the care when they're uninsured and they know they might face a really large bill. And that's also consistent with the major improvement in finances that we saw. When people got insurance, the probability of having catastrophic out-of-pocket medical expenses, meaning medical costs that were more than 30% of your income, disappeared. The odds of having a bill sent to collection because you couldn't pay dropped by something like 25%. People were much less likely to have to borrow money or skip paying other bills because of their health care expenses. So getting insurance both improved people's access to care of all sorts of different varieties and improved their finances. They didn't face large bills once they got that extra care.
Catherine Baker's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of health economics at Harvard University. We're talking about the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment. Here's Tim in Ashland. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yes, good morning. And I appreciate the topic and your guest for the research that they're performing on this topic. I have a case in point. My wife, we're both recently enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. And our insurer is AllCare. It's contracted to AllCare, which is our local servicing agency. My wife had a household accident, which resulted in glass getting embedded into her hand. And it got under the skin. And this was 6 months ago. We went for service on this. It took months for AllCare to provide approval to have this taken care of by an orthopedic surgeon to extract the glass.
Okay.
In the meantime, and right up until just 2 days ago, it resulted in some infection. She had to go to the emergency room here at Ashland Community Hospital and use their services to extract one shard of glass that was causing the infection. They detected a second shard that they couldn't get to that requires a hand surgeon. And it was only at that point that Southern Oregon Orthopedics approved the surgery she's going in today to get this done.
Okay.
So 6 months after the incident, we're finally getting service.
All right, Tim, thanks for the story, and best of luck to your wife. And so I guess that the question back to you then, Catherine Baker, is whether you looked much at speed of health care delivery under Medicaid in Oregon under this under the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment.
Yeah, this is a great question, and I certainly wish Tim's wife the very best of luck with her surgery. And I think that it highlights some of the challenges in the insurance product that people are getting. Oregon's Medicaid looks a lot like that of other states, and there are real challenges in access to specialists, in timeliness of care. We did ask people about whether they got all the care they needed, whether they had a doctor who was their doctor outside of the emergency department, whether they thought their care was of high quality, and there were big improvements when people got Medicaid relative to being uninsured. So that doesn't mean that Medicaid couldn't be improved, and in fact, Oregon is in the process of moving towards coordinated care and community-based organizations, CCOs, to try to deliver even higher quality care to people. So there's clearly a way to go, but there was a big improvement over being uninsured. People were much more likely to say that they got all the care that they needed, to say that their care was of high quality. So that's at least a step in the right direction.
Some of the reports of success at the CCOs are just coming online now, separate from this discussion. We'll probably have that in a future program on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Catherine Baker about the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment and the findings derived from it when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about further findings from the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment. You've heard us talk about this before. It was the result of the lottery used to choose new people to take part in the Oregon Health Plan, Oregon's version of Medicaid, back in 2008. Thousands of people entered the pool hoping to get into the Oregon Health Plan. The winners, so to speak, were drawn by lottery. Those people got health insurance. The rest did not, but there was this vast pool of people then from which to draw findings, people uninsured and people newly insured. And so researchers have been spending the last several years combing through volumes and volumes of data, looking at what might be out there in terms of findings about health care and quality of health care and use of health care and economics of health care, both for the providers and for the patients themselves. Catherine Baker is our guest, professor of health economics at Harvard University. You can join us at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just starting to talk about some differences in Oregon's system that are coming online or have been coming online with the coordinated care organizations and things like that. But there are some other issues that I think a few people have picked some nits with in the research here, Catherine, and that is that Oregon's Medicaid system was already somewhat different from other states and that the payouts were just a bit better. So I think you've heard some arguments about the universality of the findings that you're getting from the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment.
Yeah, and I think it's important to keep in mind that any one study, no matter how fantastic it is, and I think our study is great, no one study should be the basis of all analysis of the program going forward, or no one study can answer every question that you might have. So there's some real caveats to generalizing from our study to other states or other populations. We mentioned already that so far our study results go out about 2 years, but longer run effects might differ. Also, in our study, about 10,000 people got insurance in the end through the program. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of lives. But it's small relative to the population of Oregon or relative to the healthcare system. So you might imagine that if millions of people suddenly get insured at the same moment, that has a different effect on, you know, limited availability of appointments or the way the system adapts to having new people insured. Our 10,000 people really don't change the system or crowd the system in a way that a bigger population getting insured might. Also, Oregon's Medicaid program looks a lot like that of other states. It's managed care, as was mentioned before. It covers prescription drugs and hospitalizations. It does not cover dental or vision. So in a lot of ways, it looks like other states. The population in Oregon looks a little bit different. For example, the population in Oregon is whiter than the rest of the country in terms of race and ethnicity. So if you're looking for racial and ethnic differences in the effects of health insurance, for example, Oregon's not the right setting to do that. So there are lots of reasons to be cautious in generalizing from the Oregon study to policy going forward nationwide. That said, because of the randomized controlled trial that we were in essence able to run because of the lottery, I think the evidence is much stronger than a lot of other studies we had before.
Some of the sets of questions that people have about not just what happened in Oregon with this program, but what is happening around the country. We barely even touched on the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, at this point. But when you talk about putting a lot more people into the healthcare system, there are potential effects on that system. And are there any real clues to what you found here with getting more people into the Oregon Health Plan, therefore more people potentially using the healthcare system in ways they didn't before?
Yeah, we were wondering ahead of time whether people would be able to get access to doctors, for example, just because they had Medicaid. Did that mean they could actually get an appointment, or was it going to be really challenging? And we heard a little bit earlier about some of the challenges of getting specialized surgeries, for example. We saw big increases in the number of doctor's office visits that people had, the probability that they had a doctor who was their doctor, their satisfaction with their care. So that doesn't mean that there isn't room for improvement, but at least in the Oregon context, we saw people getting access to much more care than they had before. How that would be different if it was millions of people suddenly instead of thousands remains to be seen.
Now, one of the other areas that we talked about here was you mentioned physical and mental health in passing, and obviously we focus mostly on physical health. I want to talk a bit more about mental health and any findings you might have there that shows effects on the population of getting health insurance.
Yes, I'm glad you brought us back to that, because one of the most important findings and changes in health that we saw was a drop in rates of depression by something like 30%, which is an enormous improvement in health, and I think it's often discounted. People focus on things like blood pressure, but depression is of much higher prevalence in this population, and the 30% improvement in depression I thought was remarkable.
So that again comes back to a question about if we're looking for big black, white, yes, no, A, B, binary sorts of findings here. And in fact, if you get lots of little results, they could eventually add up to big societal changes. If you get a 30% increase or improvement in the or 30% drop, that is the level of improvement, a drop in the rates of depression by 30%. I mean, maybe it doesn't look like a binary thing to people, but over time, that's the kind of thing that can improve the quality of life for a lot of people in society and just maybe society overall.
Yes, and I think that's where it comes back to what it is policymakers are trying to achieve with the program. Some people would argue that the 30% reduction in depression and the improvement in financial security, the 25% reduction in having bills sent to collection, those alone are sufficient to justify the expenditures on the program. Other people would say, well, you know what, I don't care as much about depression as I care about blood pressure and diabetes, and if I didn't see improvements in those, then I don't think it's worth the spending on the program. And that comes down to what it is that policymakers are trying to achieve with the program and what other things they might do with those resources instead. And that's why it's important they have information about both the costs and the benefits.
Things like blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, I mean, the ones that are obvious and particularly critical because they can make a huge difference in a person's overall health in a pretty fast amount of time, pretty short amount of time. Are there things that people have suggested in changes to approach that, I mean, I know we've talked about the diabetes part a lot, that diabetes people can use up so much time in the emergency room. One Oregon State Senator, who's himself a doctor, and his district covers where we broadcast from, talks about the fact that 20% of the people use 80% of the care, and it's often for cases like diabetes, where if people would just take their medication on a more regular basis, they would not end up in the hospital. So, I mean, are there things that come out of this research that point four ways forward? Maybe you didn't get the results you might have thought would have happened in the first couple of years of the Oregon Health Insurance experiment, but it at least suggests ways to move forward?
Yeah, we saw, as I mentioned, no statistically detectable improvements in those conditions like diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure. Now, diabetes is not quite as prevalent in the population as something like high blood pressure. We didn't see improvements in diagnosis or medication for high blood pressure, but we did see increases in diagnosis of and increases in taking medication for diabetes. So there was some hint of improved care for diabetes, but the population with diabetes was small enough that we didn't end up seeing an improvement in HbA1c or diabetic blood sugar control. For high blood pressure and high cholesterol, we didn't see changes in diagnosis or medication. So that suggests that something needs to be different about managing care for populations with chronic conditions. But our study can only say how the existing Medicaid program worked or didn't work. It doesn't really give us good evidence on how changing the program would affect those outcomes. I think it's interesting to note that the big improvement we saw in depression, the medications people take for depression produce improved well-being that patients can feel pretty quickly. Medications for high blood pressure, people feel the same if they on a day they take their medication and a day they don't take their medication. So there's a large body of evidence, not from our study, but from a much wider ranging set of studies, that adherence to medications for high blood pressure, for high cholesterol, is really not successful in a lot of populations, and maybe improving that care management, not just for people on Medicaid, but population-wide, is necessary for improving those chronic conditions.
We have an email here from Annette, no town given. She's asking a fairly specific question about financial mechanics, but you might know the answer. She says, did I read the tax laws right, that the estate of a deceased person that was on Medicaid has to pay the IRS the amount of aid that person used while they were alive? That doesn't seem fair. That's from Annette. Is that a mechanism you're aware of, Catherine?
This is nothing that I have heard of.
Okay. Let us move on to Scott's email. No, he's in Ashland. He wants to know, did the subjects of the study, the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment, consent to participate and to have the researchers access all the data involved? And what steps were taken to ensure informed consent?
Yes, as I'm glad to get into the details of this, we took informed consent quite seriously, and our study was overseen by multiple institutional review boards because we had researchers from multiple institutions. So this was a very carefully monitored study. We indeed, from all the people that we interviewed, got informed consent, where we explained what the study was aiming to accomplish, what would happen with their data, how it would be protected. You know, for blood samples, we explained exactly what we would test and what we would never test, and got people's permission to do those tests, and then gave them back the information that we gleaned from the blood samples. So, for example, when we tested for cholesterol, we sent people a report saying, here's what your cholesterol level is and here's what it means, as well as recording that information in a de-identified way for future analysis. So I hope that people who participated got some benefit from that as well. And also, we heard over and over again from the people we interviewed that they were genuinely supportive of trying to improve healthcare delivery and health insurance, not just for them, but for their neighbors and their community. And they were really eager to participate. It was really affirming for us that the community cares so much about improving healthcare delivery, and were more than willing to participate in this as soon as we could reach people and explain to them what we were trying to do.
For the people who did not get into the Oregon Health Plan, was there any incentive offered for participation in the study?
Both people who were selected in the lottery and people who were not selected in the lottery participated in the same data collection modes. And that was really important to us, that we got the same data from the control group and the treatment group so that we could really isolate the effect of Medicaid and figure out what it was doing. We compensated people a small amount for their time in participating in the study and for their transportation to get to our clinics and the like. And that was the same for both the treatment and control groups.
All right, so you took care of their expenses, basically.
And gave them small compensation for their time.
Okay. Let's take a call here from Dennis in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Catherine Baker. If the button will press, there we go. Catherine Baker is with us on the Exchange, and so is Dennis. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Say, now that we have a national health care plan, I have two questions. I have a little trouble understanding why this study's relevant. And the other question is, I've heard a lot about this study, especially by political types. And if you're a conservative, it just they're all saying that it just proves that Medicaid and Medicaid don't do any good.
And you probably
and
have liberals saying the same thing,
they're
right?
saying, mm-hmm. see, this proves that everybody needs health care. So I don't really understand what is going to be accomplished by this study, other than, you know, a lot of information is collected, but nobody really knows how to do anything with it. I can give you an example
okay.
with blood pressure.
Dennis, we need to give her about 2 minutes to answer, and that's okay. about all we have left. Thanks for that. So question number one is, has this become irrelevant now that we have expanded Medicaid so greatly, particularly within Oregon?
Well, I think that it's enormously relevant, and more relevant than we even realized when we started the study, because states have the choice now of expanding Medicaid versus not up to 100% of the federal poverty line, and only about half the states have done so. So in state legislature after state legislature, there are debates about what the real costs and benefits of expanding Medicaid in their state are, and we have given them a lot of information with this study, and I've got the opportunity to spend a fair amount of time both in Washington and in state capitals explaining the study, giving people information about the results. And I think there's an enormous appetite because there's been so much rhetoric in the past, both on the left and the right, divergent points of view that really weren't substantiated by data. So I'm also, I share a little bit of the frustration that regardless of how much information you give people, some people are going to say the program is 100% good, and some people are going to say the program is 100% bad, and they're not going to be swayed by the data. And I think there's always going to be that group of people. But I think there's a substantial group of people who were open-minded enough to incorporate the new information they got. And we heard a lot less after the study of the rhetoric suggesting that being on Medicaid was worse than being uninsured. And I can show you headlines from before the study that said just that, that Medicaid was actually worse for people than being uninsured. It's very hard to say that after the study has been, the data from the study has been analyzed. You also heard a lot of people saying that we would save money by expanding Medicaid because emergency department visits would disappear. And we've shown that emergency department visits increase. And that really, I think, has changed a little bit of the rhetoric on that side. So I take the point that you're not going to change all of the minds. I wish that you could, that data was the source of everyone's beliefs on everything. But that's asking a little much of any study.
But does the study, in fact, come to an end with the expansion of Medicaid coverage in Oregon this year?
Yeah, so our study, our data collection in Oregon is over because
okay.
of that.
All right. Catherine Baker, professor of health economics at Harvard University, thanks for a very detailed look at the workings of the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment and its findings.